I'm talking with Dr. Catherine Ziff tonight. She's the author of Asylum on the Hill, which is a historic look at the Athens, Ohio lunatic asylum built in the 1860s. This being the time of year when spooky stories come to mind, we're going to learn if there are any attached to the Asylum on the Hill. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Barbara.
Your book includes photographs that were taken either inside or outside of the asylum. So the main building is a large, four-story, very impressive structure. And you write at one point in your book that a legacy of stigma still clings, taking the form of persistent, undocumented tales. University students speculate about ghosts of former patients haunting the spaces, their imaginations inspired by the immense building with its towers and stairs. This building is a part of OU, Ohio University, I should say. The spookiest photo to me is the one with the stain on the floor. And I think the stain is in the attic of one of the main buildings. So tell us about the stain, if you would.
Well, the stain is a long tale, and it goes back to the 1970s, and it pulls through to the 21st century in terms of forensic science. So it has a lot of interesting details to it. In December of 78, a female patient whose name was Margaret Schilling, this is all in the papers and well documented, disappeared from one of the female wards where she was a patient. And there were searches undertaken and inside and outside the building, and her body was not found until 3 or 4 weeks later on in January. Some maintenance folks and other staff were looking around among warehoused office space that had been closed off, and they came upon her body. The story goes, and I've talked to people who've told the story, that she was lying there, having removed her clothes and tidily folded them up by her side, lying there, of course, at this point, having deceased. Well, her body was removed and properly taken care of, her remains, and of course, there was cleanup undertaken, and shortly after that, it was noticed that a stain appeared that is, if you look in the book, you can see the picture quite obviously in the shape of a petite female body. And so you can imagine all kinds of tales grew up, and it's been a source for all these years, 30 years or 25 years of intense interest and speculation. So a few years ago, 5 or 6 years ago maybe, the History Channel brought in its operation and were determined to come to the bottom of what this stain was about. Was it a ghostly apparition? Was it something that had been caused by the interaction of sunlight streaming through the windows? What was it? So Professor Glenn Jackson, a forensic chemist at Ohio University, and a team of his students set to work sorting out what the composition of the stain was, and they determined that it was an acid byproduct of decomposition mixed with a cleaning agent. And so that's what it was, and it had been cleaned up more with a sponge rather than a big mop because the outline remained. And so this was the first time that this particular byproduct had formed in a dry, airy building. Usually it's only been seen in moist environments, and so this was a matter of contribution to forensic science, and a journal article appeared in one of the forensic science journals, and an episode of Law & Order, SVU, was based on this in May of 2009. So a story that begins very tragically with the disappearance and subsequent death of a patient extending all the way into the 21st century. But now we know what that stain is about, and it is something actually fairly ordinary.
There are also carvings on the window ledges that I assume patients left behind. Any specifically interesting one?
Well, it's just very interesting to see them. The ledges of the building itself are made out of sandstone that was mined or quarried right here in southern Ohio, quite close to Cincinnati, a particular type of sandstone. And they're on the soft side. I mean, they're hard as stones, but they're on the soft side. On the male wing, of course, the wings of the asylum were the male wing and the female wing, for several stories, are covered in layers and layers of carvings done, one imagines, perhaps by a spoon confiscated or brought from the dining room or some other relatively sharp object. And they are layered over. There are dates on there from the 19th century, Bible quotes, names of Old Testament and New Testament figures, dates, letters, words, drawings, and diagrams. And they're layered up. One thinks probably it's been kind of the opinion of the various people who have looked at it, that it's been layered up over a century of patients. So it's kind of a moving and poignant testament to the drive, the human drive to create and to express and to create images.
There is also a period of time where the treatment certainly of people was based on a kindly philosophy. And then we move into a time where surgery comes in to the process. And there was a Dr. Freeman who worked there. This sounds pretty brutal to us these days. Mm-hmm. You want to talk a little bit about what his work involved?
These were the lobotomy years. During the 1950s, Dr. Walter Freeman was a physician who performed about 3,500 lobotomies in mostly public asylums throughout the United States. And he would travel about and perform maybe as many as 30 in a day and then go on to the next asylum. He perfected a method called the prefrontal transorbital or ice pick lobotomy, in which an ice pick-like instrument was inserted into the inner part of the eye, and it severed the connections to the frontal lobe. And it was just unspeakable to think of now. I like to think perhaps it spoke to the desperation of the physicians with no other means at their disposal, overcrowded asylums, no medications that like we have today. Dr. Walter Freeman's medical license was ultimately revoked in the late 50s, early 60s, but he continued to be a proponent of his method, I believe, until his dying day. But that was one of the grimmer episodes in American psychiatry, and actually it was Western psychiatry.
I will mention also that in case people want to create their own spooky walk, there are cemeteries on the grounds. And quite honestly, there's a lot of natural beauty on these grounds also. But I'm interested in knowing, Catherine, you are a practicing mental health counselor, and I'm wondering why we do conjure up these scary stories, sometimes literally just conjuring them. There's nothing, no basis in fact for them. Sometimes there is. So what draws us to scary stuff?
Well, everyone loves a story. We know that to begin with, whether it's once upon a time or a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, we love a story. And we also enjoy being scared. We know now from neuroimaging that our brain, or many people, enjoy being frightened by stories, enjoy that process of being scared, finding it delightful. And so you combine the love of stories with this high Victorian, Italianate, Victorian architecture, which is an image straight out of Gothic fiction of the 19th century, straight out of the ghost horror genre of literature, from Poe to Robert Louis Stevenson, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Frankenstein, The Turn of the Screw, Henry James. Those were closely connected with the era in which these asylums and the Athens Asylum were built. So you couple that with the thrill of ghost stories, the unconventional explanations, the exploration of the unknown, with, I think, some of the stigma that still plays out with mental illness, and you have all the recipes for the creation and fascination with ghosts and legends around the asylum story.
Thanks so much for visiting with us tonight, telling us about the Asylum on the Hill.
It's been a pleasure.
You'll find more information about Dr. Catherine Ziff's Asylum on the Hill, History of a Healing Landscape, at WVXU.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Barbara Gray. Thank you.